Welcome to the Business Isn't Usual podcast by Rightway. I'm your host, Stuart Wilkinson. Today, we start the first part of our three-part mini-series where we focus on the election, which is now less than a month away. We focus on what's important to business owners by catching up with the major party spokespeople on small business. We start with the Minister of Small Business from Labour, Stuart Nash. Stuart is the MP for Napier, and alongside small business, also operates a portfolio for revenue and fisheries. So it's a great place for us to start. This format really allows us to get into depth on a number of subjects, and it's really exciting that we give this opportunity to you guys, our listeners, who are mainly business owners, to hear this. On today's podcast, we have a great conversation with Stuart about COVID-19 and the effects it's had on business. We also talk about the importance of digital transformation for business and the government. We talk about the policy Labour's just recently put out for small businesses. And then we take a bit of a different tact as we look at how to make big decisions in business. What can we learn from Stuart and his experience, especially through COVID and what cabinet have had to go through? We also look about what business owners can learn about marketing from MPs. They are in marketing mode, as we all know, in election year. And also Stuart's advice for business owners for the next 12 months. So it's a really long, wide-ranging conversation, which we hope you enjoy. If you do, please subscribe on the platform you're listening to this podcast, and make sure you check out our social media where you can check out all the other content that Rightway puts out. Stuart, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Stuart. Thank you very much for having me.
Great. And so this is the start of a bit of a series we're doing leading up to the election, and we were supposed to do this, I think, 3-4 weeks ago, but obviously with Auckland going in level 3 and the country going into level 2, we sort of postponed that. But it's quite good because you guys have released a lot of your policies and ideas for small business, which we'll touch on today. I guess, Stuart, you know, especially in your area, Napier, and you've obviously been around the country, we're 5 odd months now into this. What's been your experience from your point of view of how business has been affected, but also how are business owners dealing with the situation that COVID-19 has presented them?
So I've talked to a range of businesses around the country, obviously, in my role as Minister for Small Business, but certainly in the local electorate of Napier, there's been a range. I mean, travel agents are really struggling, obviously. I mean, their business is for all intents and purposes, completely dried up. To other small business owners, my office is next door to a reasonably high-end restaurant that hasn't been open for that long, actually. They've had a very good experience with their landlord, but moved into the click-and-collect space very early on when we moved from level 4 to level 3, so they got some money through the door, and they've come out, they're now doing really, really well, as I think a lot of Hawke's Bay people have decided that, you know, they need to support local businesses. I think one thing that really has impressed me across all businesses is actually across our economy, actually, is the level of resilience we've seen. Sure, you know, this has not been easy for anyone. Well, a couple of exceptions. People have understood the reasons why we've done what we've done. By and large, the vast majority have obeyed the rules. And the cost, the social cost and the economic cost and the personal cost has been high. I think we're coming out the other side of this, and it will be a slow recovery of that, there's no doubt. And, you know, we won't see a full recovery by any stretch of the imagination until we're in a business as usual environment, whatever that may look like in a post-COVID world. But, you know, I have been impressed with that resilience we have seen across our economy.
Yeah. And I think touching on a point there, Stuart, and I know you guys have talked a lot about in this in the Labour policy is, you know, people adapting their business, click and collect with that restaurant example. But, you know, we had Craig Hudson on the podcast, I think it was about 6-7 weeks ago, and he talked about the clients who were digitally enabled. They had good information at hand to make decisions they felt and through their data made fed better, you know. And you guys have put a big emphasis on trying to accelerate the adoption of digital technologies in companies and businesses. So do you want to talk a little bit about, it sounds an obvious, a silly question, but why and what prompted that focus on digital technologies from what you saw and what you've been hearing?
Yeah, sure. Well, there's something called an innovation adoption curve. And, for anyone who's done fifth form maths, it's like a bell curve. And, you've got those who are early adopters who will adopt any form of technology really quickly in order to drive productivity or gain some form of competitive advantage. And then at the other end of that curve, you've got the laggards who really aren't interested in technology in any way, shape, or form. They see no value to it, either to their business or to them personally. What we're seeing, though, is that digital innovation adoption curve has just basically been thrown out the window. As people are now, you know, they've looked over that proverbial fence during different alert levels and seen their competitors do well or survive, I should say, not do well, and say, goodness me, I need to be a part of this. I need to understand now what digital technologies, and you know, we're talking anything from a basic website all the way through to data analytics, and this is really what Craig is talking about, is using data to make better business decisions. You know, again, Craig and the MYOB guys are similar to this. You know, they have hundreds of thousands of clients in this country, but very few actually use data in a way that will allow them to make optimal decisions in order to drive business growth. Now, you know, I'm a realist. You know, I know that the vast majority of business owners are, you know, they don't want to necessarily grow. They don't necessarily want to employ people. And so, you know, we're not saying that use these tools in order to employ more people or to expand revenues. It's really providing business owners with an opportunity to do whatever they want to do. And you know, for a large number of business owners, it's just more time. It's freeing up time to either spend on their business or spend with friends and family or on hobbies. But I think what we're finding now is, and I've said this quite a bit, Stuart, in pre-COVID, whenever I spoke to chambers of commerce or to business audiences, I used to say that I think this is probably the last generation of business owner that will survive, let alone thrive, without being digitally enabled. And the reason I said that is because all the tools that are put together and the systems that are being developed by Inland Revenue as well as government require a level of digital enablement. Now, you know, the Inland Revenue, and I'm also the Minister of Revenue, the Inland Revenue Business Transformation Project is the largest in the state sector. It's a cost of about $1.4 billion over 5 years. But what that is doing is migrating businesses from, you know, paper returns to online services. Yeah. And similarly in the small business space, I mean, we have something called e-invoicing, which the Prime Minister announced very early on in 2018 and said this is a high priority for the government. And it's something that I've been pushing and driving quite hard over the last sort of 2.5 years. And what it is it's my accounting software talking to your accounting software and making smart decisions. So, you know, that old construct of, you know, you pay your invoices 20th of the month following doesn't need to be that way. And certainly when I became the minister, Fonterra had payment terms of 150 days from end of month of invoice. I mean, that is just totally unacceptable, unnecessary. And to give credit where credit's due, the new Fonterra CFO has come in and accepted that this is not the way they need to do business. And they're now paying 60% of their small business customers and suppliers within 10 working days. But using something like e-invoicing means that businesses can be paid within 10 working days. It means that their invoices are correct. And NB tells me that 30% of small business invoices are incorrect. So if your payment terms are 20th of the month following, you send your invoice in, it's incorrect, it gets sent back, then you're back in that cycle again and you're not paid for 90 or 100 days. Now imagine the decisions that businesses can make, the different decisions they can make when they're getting paid within 10 days versus 50 days. Now the only way that can happen is if you are digitally enabled and you're using tools that at the moment, you know, they are innovative, but they will very, very quickly become business as usual. But back to your point around COVID, I mean, McKinsey, who are a large American business consultancy, wrote a paper and said that in the United States, they saw 5 years worth of innovation adopted within 8 weeks. Yep. And I think it's probably pretty similar here because, you know, businesses, you have got your classic tech businesses or those, you know, engaged owners who understand the value of technology. But I'm talking about, you know, your plumbers, your builders, your restaurants, your retailers, for whom didn't see any value or very little value in technology, who now are saying we need to be part of this. And what we want to be able to do is take advantage of this window of opportunity and say, hey, you know, we're going to back you on this. We're going to give you the resources needed for you to undertake that capability build, so you can also be part of this revolution going forward. And one thing I will say, Stuart, is I set up a small business council when I first became the Minister of Small Business. And it had small business owners, obviously, but it also had key stakeholders in the small business space, like bankers, accountants, tax experts. I had Fonterra on that board. I got a little bit of jip for putting Fonterra there, but I said, you know, this is New Zealand's largest company. They need to understand where the pressure points are for small businesses. And they came out with 22 recommendations, but grouped under four different headings. And I've retained, the Small Business Council has disbanded, but I've retained four key advisors from that council. And the Labor Party, every single one of the Labor Party policies fits under one of those four key themes. Yeah. And so the policy that we've outlined is, you know, I like to think is sector-led and will make a really real difference. So that's, you know, access to capital, very important for small business owners. You know, building capacity and capability. Again, what the Small Business Council found is a number of business owners, this is obviously pre-COVID, they understood they probably needed to do something, but they were busy running a business and, you know, being a mother or a father and a coach and a friend, and they felt they just didn't have the time, but they knew they needed to do something. Another one was reducing compliance, the cost of compliance and regulation. And again, a number of the policies we've put in place helps with that. And so, you know, those are the three key themes under which our policies all lie. And as mentioned, I think at this point in time, we have a window of opportunity that won't last forever, but it's a government's role not to tell people what to do, but I think to be an enabler. And this is one thing I've pushed my staff to be. You know, we don't have all the answers, we don't have all the resources, but we do have an ability to fund in a way that other institutions don't. We have an ability to bring people together. And so the role of the government in this space is actually one of enablement as opposed to, you know, direct service delivery, if that makes sense.
Yeah. No, it makes complete sense. And I think you're right, Stuart. I think what we've seen, and I think Xero is a classic example where, you know, 300,000 businesses use Xero in New Zealand. It's more than one in two sort of thing. But, you know, a lot of our clients and a lot of business owners have seen Xero just still as their accounting software, not as the life or the heart or the brain of their business, as and actually using it to go, well, if I have this up to date, if I have this linked with my CRM or my building software that manages my jobs, I can get really good information to then understand what's going to move me forward. And I think the digital stuff that we're talking with the clients, it's not massive stuff, some of these things, whether it's using Xero to get paid quicker through Stripe or something like that, but it's all these 1%ers make a big difference and often means you can spend more time on your business, whether that's out, you know, growing it, whether it's doing whatever it's you do best, or as you said, more time, family, or other things you've got in your life. And I think the adoption is seen as, oh, it's too hard and it's too much change, but it frees up so much capacity within business. So, on that, you've talked a lot about the government change. And I guess, you know, the stereotypical view of the government is they're going to be the last ones to change, maybe in the digital world. But there's obviously a big emphasis here that they are coming with the times. And I guess, you know, there's more you can do, in example, with Xero, with submitting GST returns directly, you know, into the IRD. So there's obviously a big focus here on the government teams and the departments getting up to speed.
Look, I've been of the very clear view that I can't go out and talk to small business owners and say, you know, this is going to improve your business and, you know, you've got to do this in order to be part of that, for example, without the state doing exactly the same. You know, that would be hypocritical, and there's nothing worse than a hypocritical politician. I think most would agree. So, you know, and the first thing we did when we went into lockdown level four is myself, the Prime Minister, and the Minister of Finance actually sent a letter to all state sector agencies and departments and said, we are requiring you to pay 95% of your invoices within 10 working days. Yep. We've also said to all of them that we're running an e-invoicing rollout across the state sector, and we want you to be part of this. We need you to be part of this. That's led by the CFO of MBIE, who really went hard on payment terms when he became the CFO and is driving the e-invoicing move. And really, you are right. There is a perception that, you know, we're here from the government, we're here to help. Yeah, really? Well, we want to make that a reality because, you know, we're responsible for a significant proportion of the invoices generated in the economy within the wider New Zealand economy.
Yep.
And if we are not seen to be doing the right thing, then we're never going to get the buy-in from those who would benefit. I mean, one of the great tools we do have is the business.gov.nz website and the newsletter that comes out. And when Inland Revenue, in one of the releases they undertook earlier this year, cleaned all their data, they had something like 800,000 email addresses. And this is for business owners and directors and others that they engage with. And they gave those clean email addresses to business.gov.nz, so they have a reach of 800,000 emails. And you know, some people will be getting their newsletter two or three times. What we do find is that service has been incredibly widely used. You know, some they get 500,000 clicks. Their newsletter gets read by 300,000 people, according to the analytics. And so we've found that as a very effective way of getting messages out to small business. But you know, we have to also be part of this journey. We have to streamline our digital capability as well. So when you know, when we're asking small businesses to, you know, to go to use MyIR, for example, then MyIR is easy enough for small businesses to be able to engage with. There's no point in us developing a whole lot of complex tools that you've got to be a software engineer to be able to use.
Yes,
and go out to the business, you know, go out to the small business sector and say, "Thou shalt adopt business or digital tools," when we're not enabled ourselves. So for me, it's very clear that we need to be part of this journey as well. And but let me give you one example. I mean, one of the key themes that the Small Business Council came up with is reducing the cost of compliance due to regulation and legislation. So we put a unit in place that has gone through and already found 100 different regulations or pieces of legislation that can be pulled back because they're not relevant or they have an undue impact on small businesses. And we'll continue that. And my vision for this team is what will happen is people will be seconded in from, you know, from Inland Revenue, from Workplace, from Health and Safety, from a whole lot of different agencies that interact with small businesses. They'll be there for, you know, 12 to 18 months. And then what they'll do is they'll be replaced. So slowly what we're doing is we're building up a very strong awareness within the state sector of the impact of government regulations and legislation on small businesses, and a small business lens will be cast across everything we do because it's, you know, it's really important. Another example is, you know, you show me, and you'd know this better than most, Stuart, you show me one business owner that really loves our provisional tax regime, and I'll show you 100 that, you know, that tear their hair out every time.
Yep.
There is something called the accounting income method. It's a sort of a pay-as-you-go form of provisional tax. It is hellishly complex, and I think there's about 2,000 businesses that have taken it up. It doesn't need to be nearly as complex as it is. And the concept, when I talk to business audiences, they love it. And so, you know, I've talked to the you know, the big end of town, I've talked to Inland Revenue and small businesses themselves. And we need to be able to get this right. What we have said is we will hugely simplify AIM, or the accounting income method, to allow people to run a sort of a pay-as-you-go provisional tax regime, which I think will make it a lot easier for people to keep up with their tax obligations without having to be either really disciplined and have that tax account, or, you know, or every now and again try to forecast what they're going to earn next year based on last year's earning when the environment doesn't look nearly as rosy as it used to. So we've got to be able to do things better in this space to make it easier for small businesses to comply.
Yeah, and one of my questions was on AIM because, we, you know, we've had, oh, I don't know, top of my head, how many clients we've got onto AIM, but you know, you're right, Stuart, when you talk at the headline acts of the pay-as-you-go tax method, it sounds awesome and people want it because it is a, it's, it seems complex. It's can be chunky for businesses. And I think because of what COVID's done and the uncertainty of revenues and profit that that's led to is businesses that have had consistent profits and consistent results go, okay, I know kind of what's going to happen. You know, people might do better than they think over the next 12 months, they might not. And so that all impacts on provisional tax. So, you obviously had this in the Labour policy. Was this just because of the the uptake has been not what you expected, that you're going to look at it again? Or is it just feedback, or is it a mixture of everything that's one of the reasons you're going to really give this a bit of a look?
It's a mixture of everything, but I suppose where the start, and I've been a big fan of this, but where it started is I have regular meetings with the large end of town, the Society of Australian New Zealand Accountants, and they've said to me in their last meeting, you know, they said, if you guys can get the AIM regime up and running, we think this could really be a great benefit to the small business sector. I mean, obviously these guys know that one of my portfolios is small business, and I, you know, and when I talk to the accounting profession, I do so with my revenue hat on, but also with my small business hat on, realizing that, you know, the small businesses are not only the backbone of our economy, they're also the backbone of our communities.
Yeah.
And so, you know, they've actually been very proactive in coming up with policies that they think will help small business. And this is one that they, you know, they've pushed recently, and I've spoken to revenue officials, and I've obviously spoken to, you know, Grant Robinson, the Minister of Finance, and says this is something that I think we really need to do. Everyone's on board. Talking to the small business sector and different chambers since lockdown, again, everyone said this would make life so much easier, but you've got to simplify it. And so, you know, everyone believes it can be simplified. There's a tax guru called Robin Oliver, who worked for Inland Revenue for a number of years in policy. He's written a paper that's actually outlined how it could be made simpler. And it's, you know, it wouldn't be difficult to make it simple. And so that is, you know, that's a big push of mine. But, you know, we want to make it easy for small businesses to do business. You know, it's not my role as Minister for Small Business, and it's not certainly not the government's role to make sure that businesses succeed, or it's not our role either to make sure that businesses can grow. It is our role, however, to create an environment that allows businessmen and women to be the best they can. You know, there are market forces out there that we have no control over that will determine whether businesses do well or not. And a lot of that is up to the skill of the, you know, the business owner. But if we can create an environment that allows business people to be as best as they possibly can, then I think, you know, we'll be doing our job.
Yep. And I think, you know, it links very much that opening part you talked about, Stuart, with digitalization and, you know, the accounting software is getting more digital. I guess technology is allowing us to be a bit more flexible and agile with things like AIM, because data is readily available to make better decisions and submit into IRD and all that sort of stuff. So I think the technology is now there to make it frictionless to a degree.
And, you know, in the past, you used to have you know, a separate room where you had banks and banks of really expensive computers. And, you know, you and I will have seen how the corporates used to run these, or the big companies. You know, this was a really expensive investment in driving productivity. You don't need that these days. You know, Craig Hudson will talk about the fact that you can download data and put it into an Excel spreadsheet and analyze that in a way that in the past you've never been able to. So not only is it an investment in someone's individual competencies and capability, but we're also, you know, backing small businesses to, you know, to buy that that bit of kit they need, which may cost them $2,000-$4,000 as opposed to $20,000-$50,000, which, you know, for a number of small businesses is an investment they just can't afford. But now with the tools out there, it, you know, it's at their fingertips.
Yep. Yep. One of the things that, and we've been involved as with the Regional Business Partner Network as a registered supplier, and I, you know, what personally I think it was one of the best things that I think was released, even though, you know, wage subsidy was massively important, but at that time to be able to give support to business owners through a time of dire circumstances for some of them. What's and you guys obviously I think about 3-4 weeks ago increased the funding into the Regional Business Partner sort of scheme. And so for all the listeners that are not aware, it's funding available for business owners on things like cash flow, business continuity, digital and enhancements, marketing, up to I think $5,000, which has been really good through the local body. So you obviously got some good feedback from the first round, Stuart, to then put more money in. So what was the feedback you had around that scheme and some of the success stories in some ways as well?
Oh, look, this is something I'm very passionate about. So the Regional Business Partner Network has existed for a while now, and it's been matched funding. So, you know, we've put money in 50-50 as long as the business owner also contributes. When we went into initial lockdown, we put $4 million into that, and we said it won't be match funding, it'll be just 100% government funded. That disappeared really quickly. We put another $15 million into that. And this is something that I'm really passionate about because I understand the results and the value it adds. That disappeared really quickly as well. So, I wrote a paper on this based on the feedback that I'd got and what I was hearing around the traps from both organizations that were part of this. And I know that your organization, Stuart, has been a very valuable part of this, as well as small businesses that had taken up the opportunity, as well as chambers as well.
Yeah.
And so we put another $40 million into this because we recognized that the value this was adding in terms of helping small business owners migrate or move through difficult times was just invaluable. So there's been a combination of feedback I've got. So the wage subsidy, you know, I've had businesses say to me, this saved my business. You know, there was no two ways about it. And we were the first country in the world to get money out the door. So it allowed businesses a little bit of breathing space to take a step back and say, okay, where's my business headed from here? I don't need to lay off my staff. Gives them, you know, it allows them to continue to provide food and, you know, and shelter for their families. But also what it's the regional business partner $5,000 fund has really allowed a lot of these businesses who didn't have time perhaps in the past.
Yep.
Take a good hard look at their business, or found themselves in a situation where, goodness me, you know, what am I going to do next? You know, I don't, you know, my revenue has tanked. My customers aren't buying. You know, there's no foot traffic downtown. How the hell do I cope? And you know, they've talked to people like you, Stuart, and you've provided advice that in the past they've had to pay money for, or they didn't know existed. And they've been able to get through. And for a number, it's provided a different direction. There's a company here, actually. They're called Stim. It's a guy who left the banking industry. And he's, you know, he's one of these classic Kiwi handymen. They make furniture, high-end furniture, out of wine barrels, believe it or not.
And, oh, yeah,
you know,
cool.
I bought stuff off them myself. It really is first class. And they found themselves in huge trouble. They went through the Regional Business Partner Network. And as a consequence of that, they set up a website and they've done a couple of webinars and their business has just gone great guns. In fact, they're at a point now where they're having to make a decision around moving out of the garage or the large shed that they constructed, employing someone else, and their business is growing in these troubled times. But, you know, it's one of these things where, you know, government does have a role to play in helping businesses be as good as they can, but also seeing them through crises like this. I mean, you know, we put the economy into level four, right? I mean, we had to do it because we always said that the best economic response was a health response. But this is, you know, the government did this. And it's my view, and certainly the Prime Minister's view, is that because of the really strict imposition of the alert levels, we also have a duty of care to those businesses who were impacted by this. Yeah. And so we said, okay, let's provide, you know, really sound expert advice like your company has done, Stuart, to these men and women and allow them to move from sort of the shock of lockdown into the next phase of recovery. And I think it's been, you know, it's been hugely successful. I would encourage anyone who is listening to this who has struggled or hasn't taken advantage of this to please do it. As mentioned, it's free. And you get expert advice like the experts from your company, Stuart, but it's around, you know, digital enablement, maybe health and well-being, it may be,
yep,
you know, managing stress, it may be you know, legal advice. And the thing is it may be advice, you know, the advice you might get may be, hey, you know what, you need to close your business. And so it is, you know, business owners do need to make really hard decisions about where they go, as mentioned, to move from lockdown into recovery and then into a business's as usual environment. And that business as usual environment may be completely different from what we used to pre-COVID.
Yeah. And I think what we found, and you know, it's definitely changed now, the sort of we're looking a bit longer ahead, but through the regional business partner funding and working with clients, you know, it was week by week sometimes. You know, the example of the wine barrel company, when, you know, revenue's gone from X to 20%, 0% is what can we do this week? Okay, let's focus on these three actions, you know, using Xero and software to forecast out different scenarios. Okay, did we achieve what we wanted to? But mm-hmm. And often we found it was for business owners, not just advice, but actually also someone else to speak to. We had a client who was speaking to one of our business partners, and it was pretty dire, and they've done all right, but he hadn't told his family how tough it was. And he was like, I don't want to, the stress of, and so this is, I think, that the emotional support of having someone to talk to that's, not in the inner circle of the family, whatever it is, was also a massive help to a lot of business owners through that time.
And then the other thing, Stuart, is, the company I was talking about, Stim, he is very, him and his wife are very good at what they do, but we can't expect small business owners to be experts in all areas. And that's why we allowed them to access an expertise that they obviously didn't have, nor should we expect them to have. And so from that perspective, I think it has perhaps opened the eyes of a number of small business owners to actually what exists out there. But, your point about a company, this business owner who hadn't told his family, one of the things I loved about what Xero was doing in this mental health space is that this is, in a normal course of event, running a small business is incredibly stressful. Under a COVID environment, it can be the breaking point. So, we've put a number of mental health initiatives in place. If people are keen, go on to business.gov.nz and take a look at this. We're pushing this quite hard. But, Xero did that survey about a year ago. And I think 40%, it was that high, 40% of people said that running a business impacted on their mental health. And the more people, the more employees a small business owner had, the more stressful it was. So I think it's one of these things that that the general population don't actually realize.
Yeah.
Running a small business can be really difficult, and it can have an impact on mental health. And I think as a society, and certainly as a government, we have a responsibility to put these tools in place that will allow small business owners, in fact, everyone in our population, to access mental health tools as and when it's necessary.
Yeah. Just wanted to sort of dig into something, Stuart, you mentioned earlier about the speed about what the money came out for wage subsidy. And look, we obviously saw that with clients and just were like, this is fantastic how quickly the funds were coming out. And I guess, again, that stereotype of government is think it doesn't move the fastest of all things. So what has had to happen to make sure money came out? I guess it's probably more advice for other business owners here on, there was obviously a bit of a cultural change, or there was a realization, there was a bit of a vision set of what you were trying to do through that. So, was there adversity to how quick that came up? Like, how did you get through to that space of going, okay, we need to get money out, but there's the wheels of government that we've got to get through. So how did you make that happen?
Yeah, it's a very good question. Look, we recognised we were heading into uncharted waters. We also recognised that the decisions we're about to make were going to have a real significant impact on employers and employees. And if we didn't move really, really quickly, there were going to be dire consequences. Government tends to operate under a model where we need our systems to have a high degree of integrity. But with that high degree of integrity comes a lot of modelling and a lot of work and a lot of consultation. We didn't have time for that. So what we did is we moved to a very high trust model. I mean, we inherently trust Kiwis, but we know that there are those out there who may seek to take advantage of programs and processes we put in place. But this time, we just had to move incredibly quickly. So what we did is we said, in essence, we trust you to do the right thing. Apply and you're going to get the money. I visited a business down here who was in dire trouble. They applied and the money was in their bank account by the end of the day. We guaranteed it within 5 days. But as a consequence of that, it didn't have the level of, I suppose, integrity that, for example, Inland Revenue tend to demand when they put out processes. But the trade-off with that is getting money out the door. And so, there was very quick decisions that had to be made around cabinet. We all understood the implications of what we were doing. We knew that this was going to cost the taxpayer a significant amount of money. But in the end, it ended up supporting about 1.7 million workers at a cost of about $13 billion. We think that was money incredibly well spent because it saved jobs. And we know that, and it saved companies. The other action we could have taken is what a number of other countries actually did and said, okay, We need to understand the data a little bit more. We need to understand the situation that we're entering into. We're going to do a lot more modeling. We're going to do a lot more consultation. And then once we understand the situation, then we'll get money out the door. We simply did not have time for that. I mean, let me give you a rather extreme example. We implemented something called loss carryback, which meant that firms that had been profitable in the past, if they were going to lose money in the current tax year, then they could claim back some of the tax they'd actually paid against losses as opposed to carrying those losses forward. This sort of legislation would usually take between 18 and 24 months. We rolled it out in 2 weeks. Now, again, was it perfect? No, it wasn't. Could it have been better? Well, it may be better because this is something that I'm committed to, you know, to establishing in legislation going forward as opposed to a temporary measure. But was it necessary? Absolutely. And, you know, there are times when we really do have to act with limited information and get it, say, 75% right, then fuller information and get it 95% right. And this is very definitely one of these cases. But the other thing, Stuart, that we did, and this was a cabinet decision and these were the words we used, is that we were going to have a no regrets way of managing in this pandemic. So everything we did, we were not going to look back and say, shivers, we regretted doing that, we should have done it better. And like I said, these were actually the words we used. So when we rolled out the wage subsidy, it was going to be under a no regrets policy. When we gave $40 million to, you know, regional business partners, we weren't going to look back and say, shivers, you know, maybe we should have sought more data. We said, yeah, no regrets, let's do this. And, you know, if we need to change legislation to tweak things and, you know, going forward, then we will do that. And we have done that. But it was, let's get this 75% right and do it, then wait for data to get it 95% right. But the consequences of that would be jobs were lost, businesses folded, and, you know, and the economy tanked even further.
Yeah, yeah. I was conscious of time, Stuart, but I got a couple more questions to wrap up, which I guess moves us on to, we're in the election time, and I thought one of the things I was trying to prepare for this interview is what can business owners learn from MPs, and I guess at the moment in election time, you're in the marketing game, you know, you're out there selling your message and selling yourselves, and so from your point, Stuart, you know, what can business owners learn about marketing from what MPs do through the election, in your opinion?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I'm a salesman. Okay, I've got to go out there and I've got to tell a better story. But you know, I've come from a marketing background in the past. One thing I try and do in my electorate is dominate. It's called dominate the hoardings. It's in essence get your brand out there better and more powerful. My words are wrong. In a way that is significantly stronger than the other guys. Yeah. Another thing is I've got to create a value proposition, right? Why would people vote for me as opposed to voting for my opposition? And so I've gone out there with a very strong value proposition that hopefully voters will buy into. But, you know, this is a sort of a four-month job interview that I hope the value proposition that I put out there is strong enough to convince voters to back me. Now, obviously, they won't all do that. But in a competitive environment, like any form of market, you hope that your value proposition is stronger than everyone else's. So it's articulating a value proposition in a way that your customers can actually, you know, go, I get this. Yeah. I am going to support that business or support that politician or you know, go to that restaurant. And I've been a businessman my whole life. As mentioned, I was a general manager marketing. That was last century in a time before, you know, Instagram and all these other digital tools, but the principles themselves are the same.
Yeah.
You know, you've got to define your competitive advantage. You've got to tell a really good story around why customers would support you. You've got to outline that value proposition in a way that people can buy into. And then most importantly, you've got to deliver. But one thing I would say, Stuart, is when I turned up in Napier, which is my hometown, the National MP had a majority of 9,300. Now, by most measures, that's a safe seat. And, you know, I ended up winning the seat. And how I did that, and there's no other way of doing this, is actually just working really, really hard.
Yeah.
And, you know, like business, there are very few safe seats. I mean, Labor is never going to win Selwyn, and National is never going to win Mangere, no matter how hard someone works. But in between those two extremes, there are a number of seats that over the years have switched between Labor and National and back again. And the only way to win a seat or hold on to a seat is by working really hard. And it's my experience that that's the only way you can, you know, you can run a successful business. It's working really hard, as well as, you know, as mentioned, telling a good story, articulating a value proposition, getting your brand out there, and really defining your competitive advantage. But one thing I will say, and this is where, you know, we're really trying to invest and work hard with small businesses and have the back of small businesses. And it's also working really smart.
Yep.
And I think in this day and age is the use of digital tools. I mean, we're using Facebook and Instagram and Twitter in a way that we've never used it before. And I suppose that's what we're saying to small business owners as well, is those who haven't engaged in digital technologies, they also now need to use those digital tools in a way they haven't used before to get to customers, to articulate their value proposition and define their competitive advantage.
Yeah, and I think you're right, because if times are tough and things are not working, you doing more of the same thing that's not working and working hard won't get you out of the problem. So it is, you know, thinking it differently, but executing. And I think the value proposition is excellent, actually. Final question, Stuart, before you go. What's your advice for business owners over the next 12 months?
What I would say is, you know, don't look at the past. You know, things have been very tough. Look forward. What I do say often is, you know, we've got your back. Government has your back on this. We're going to work really closely with you to allow you to transition into recovery phase. It is going to take a while for our economy to recover, and it is going to take a while for a lot of small business owners to get revenues, let alone profits, up to where they were pre-COVID. But the one thing I would urge you to do is take advantage of the opportunities that are out there in the form of government support. The Regional Business Partner Program, you know, I can't understand why a business wouldn't take advantage of $5,000 of free advice from experts. You know, if we're fortunate enough and privileged enough to be in government again, we are going to roll out a lot of innovative ways that small businesses can pivot to the next phase of growth, and this will be around digital enablement. Yeah. What I would say is engage with your Chamber of Commerce. Go along when politicians like myself or in officials or when chambers are holding networking or education evenings, because these are the places that you're going to pick up ideas around how to move to the next phase of your business. There is a lot of support out there. I urge you to take it up, but also not just around how to move to a digital environment or how to operate in a digital environment or a level one COVID environment. But I also urge people, if they feel the need to talk to someone about the issues that are weighing heavy on their shoulders, then please take advantage of that as well. As Kiwis, and certainly as Kiwi males, we are really, really bad at admitting when things aren't going well. But there is a support out there to help people get through this. But you know, the next 12 months for a number of businesses, it is still going to be tough, Stuart. It really is. We have got your back. We're here to support you. We want you to be as best as you possibly can. We also want productivity to increase. We want businesses to move to digital platforms. But we are here to support you. I've got your back if I'm fortunate enough to be in this portfolio going forward. But hang in there. We back you and we believe in you.
Awesome. And that's a great sign off, I think, Stuart. But thank you very much taking time at your busy schedule to be on the podcast.
My absolute pleasure, Stuart. And good luck to all small businesses going forward. And thank you to your business, Stuart, for the amazing work it has done in terms of supporting small businesses through the Regional Partner Network over this COVID environment and COVID period.
Thanks, Stuart.
Cheers, mate.